Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
Donald Trump's isolationist and anti-trade rhetoric aimed at Asia presents Canada with a unique opportunity to distinguish ourselves from the United States. What are we doing to seize that opportunity and use it to our advantage in international relations? How should we move forward to take part in Asian markets, where previously we've failed to rise to the occasion? In particular, what is our nation's plan in recognizing and moving in on opportunities in Asia-Pacific, an economic region that is home to 65% of our worldwide population? We sat down and talked with Stuart Beck, the president and CEO of the Asia-Pacific Foundation, for a conversation that matters.
Stuart Beck, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
In that map behind you, there is an area that's circled that is Asia-Pacific. It encompasses or is home to about 65% of the world's population, I believe, and growing. Mm-hmm. How have we done as a country in being able to capitalize on this endowment that was handed to us by Pierre Trudeau when he first recognized China? I think he opened the door and we could have done well.
Well, let's face it, we've had a long history in Asia. So mm-hmm. there are companies like Sun Life and Manulife that have had 100 years of history in that part of the world. And of course, we weren't necessarily a country whose foreign policy was run by Canada, and then it was run by the Brits way back when. But we, I think, have missed the boat in many, many ways. And the foundation was established in the mid-80s to really capture the importance of Asia. And at that time, Asia was Japan. You know, you roll forward, nobody even thought then of what the role China would be playing.
Right.
And here you are, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, China is beginning to take off. I was in Shanghai at the time of its really enormous growth phase, 10, 12% growth per annum. And we didn't really understand that. So working there, trying to convince Canadian companies that, hey, this is where the market will be. We had 1% of the import Chinese import market, and or 1.4% of the Chinese import market in 1999. Trying to convince people that this is where it would happen. Now we lost the. My own view is that, you know, we come from a Western Europe, Eastern Europe immigration pattern. We have been living next to the largest market in the world, so we never really needed to think about, or never even really understood Asia to become such a big force in the world as it is today. Mm-hmm. And so we're behind the eight ball, we're behind Australia. So I said we were 1.4% of the Chinese import market in 1999. 2014, we were 1.39% of the Chinese import market, even though it's become our second largest trading partner. Whereas the Australians in 1999, it was 2.2% of the Chinese import market represented Australia, now it's 5%.
Okay. So what did they do in Australia that we didn't do?
Well, I would say maybe 10 years ago, they did a white paper on the importance of Asia. Keep in mind, Asia for Australia is the United States for Canada, so it's, mm-hmm. it's their backyard. They then did this strategy. It was a white paper. It was probably about 120 pages long, maybe more. I can't remember exactly. But they resourced it, okay? And when you resource a strategy like that and you build Asia competence in the country, you understand that this is where your bread and butter is going to be. You go out and you negotiate free trade agreements and foreign investment protection agreements. You put in place the instruments that were going to help you engage better from a commercial perspective.
And you do it early.
And you do it early. And you're seen as, you know, let's face it, both Canada and Australia are resource commodity providers to China during its growth phase, and also to Japan and Korea, if you take a look back historically. Mm-hmm. But they understood that they needed to have the right instruments in place. So how many free trade agreements do we have in force in Asia? We have one.
One.
Okay, whereas the Australians have eight in force. Okay, so we had, you know, we were negotiating with the TPP, and of course that's gone by the boards. We're talking now about doing one with China. Initial stages, but something I think is important for us to engage in if we want to capitalize on that opportunity that exists. Again, not just in China, because China is becoming a force in all of Asia. So what we need to make sure we're a part of is that intra-regional trade that's going to be going on. between
So how do we do that? Because we are not a major player. We're not as close to Asia as Australia is, and we didn't act early. We were too reliant on our north-south relationship with the United States.
I take a page from the BC playbook. BC playbook. So, I mean, I'm talking from the country's perspective. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you look back to when Gordon Campbell came into government, it was about the time that we were going through another negotiation on the, it was a little bit later that we were going into another softwood lumber conversation. And I think BC came to the realization that, you're on the Pacific, you understand that, China, Japan, Korea, particularly, are very important for the province. You had the problems that existed with softwood lumber. I was in Shanghai at the time, and between the federal government and BC, they put in place a strategy to build an ecosystem to support the sales of softwood lumber into China,
mm-hmm.
basically wood frame construction.
And so, it worked.
And it worked because you had to, again, it was a strategy. It was something that you had to resource over a period of time. You realize it's not going to happen overnight because you have to make sure the building codes are in place. People are trained to become carpenters. You have to train the architects on how to use the material.
Mm-hmm.
All that is a time-consuming activity. But if you take a look from flash to bang, it was probably about 5 years. And now take a look at where China is in terms of a export market for BC softwood. I felt the same way when I was in India. Again, similar type of construction patterns, concrete, cement. People wouldn't really normally think about wood frame construction. You have to introduce this as an ecosystem into that market. Now it's another market of a billion people. Okay. So it makes sense for the BC government to be and the Canadian government working in concert to build that market in India for softwood lumber.
But that takes a commitment to investment.
That's right.
From not only the British Columbia government, but that of the government of Canada. And the government of Canada gets drawn into this north-south relationship so much. Do you feel that right now this may be our last gasp at having an opportunity when we take a look at the geopolitical forces that are at work out of the United States right at the moment with the current occupant of the White House?
Well, I would cast it a little differently.
Okay.
I would say it's ours to seize the moment. Okay, this is an opportunity for us right now because we are being differentiated from the United States. We're seen as an open, tolerant, Western, developed economy that has good governance. A lot of things that emerging markets are looking to.
And we're open to trade.
And we're open to trade. And we are a hub. Okay, so we have NAFTA. We now have CETA. It positions us well, so we can seize this moment. Again, it's about being strategic, and it's about resourcing that strategy for us to capitalize on that. So if you think of it, from electoral cycles, okay, so the Liberals have another 2 years in their electoral cycle, and then we have probably three and a bit years in the U.S. cycle, so we really need to do things to kind of change and pivot our and diversify into the Asian market.
So here's the challenge, though. We take a look at a market like China now of more than a billion people, India more than a billion people, hundreds of millions.
600 million.
Yeah, it's enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Do our companies and the, because these are the organizations that are going to start to trade into that market, do we have the ability to scale up to meet the needs of that market? Because it's been said to me, if China all of a sudden decides that it likes your product, look out, you're not going to have any other customer, and you'll be lucky to be able to meet demand. Yeah. And so,
and it impacts us too.
Right.
So when you think about lobster, for example, the Chinese like lobster. The Chinese have found Canadian lobster. Companies on the east coast of Canada are doing very, very well. $800 million worth of sales. That begins to impact our own pricing in our country. That's just one example. Cherries.
Mm-hmm.
Blueberries. These are all things that, because Canada is seen as being, high quality, safety, food safety, all these things make us an attractive place to be buying product. So, that's just, unless it happens in India as well. So we need to understand, we're very good, if we're talking about agriculture, being able to efficiently grow more mm-hmm. and still maintain our safety and quality. Mm-hmm. So if we anticipate that this is what's going to happen, but the question becomes then, do we have the transportation infrastructure to be able to deliver it, right?
Yeah.
So once we make a commitment to it, to say, yes, we are going to commit to this huge opportunity for us in Asia, then we have to kind of build the other elements into that system to make it work.
But it's going to have to take a commitment on behalf of the Canadian government, maybe not necessarily to put the money in, but to at least guarantee the loans of organizations that say, okay, we're going to do this, but we can't do it on our own. And that changes the nature of government-business relationships and so on, but I can't see us doing it without it.
No, but I think there is a receptivity right now, partly because of what's going on in the United States. Don't get me wrong, we have to get NAFTA right. That's our bread and butter. But I think we're now being able to understand that this is where we really have to invest time, effort, energy, strategy, money going forward. So you can't do it all at once. So you know the fact that the previous Liberal and Conservative governments invested in the gateway infrastructure, that was important.
But here, the reality is
in British Columbia.
Yeah.
More needs to be invested.
I know it's not enough.
It's not enough. So, I mean, our most recent poll, suggests that Canadians are supportive of investing more in transportation infrastructure to capitalize on the opportunity. So,
and that's a change, though, isn't it?
Yes.
You're noticing a change there in that level of support, not only for that, but also for having free trade agreements.
We're up 19 points over 2014. We're at 55% of Canadians support a free trade agreement. 68% of Canadians see China playing a leadership role in the global economic environment. So people are beginning to understand. Our poll in 2016 was 12 points above 2014 in the context of do Canadians see themselves as part of the Asia-Pacific region. So we're now at 36% over 24 in 2014.
So we're starting to get
to understand. And you've got to remember, too, the face of Canada is changing. Mm-hmm. So for the last 5 years, the top three source countries for immigrants have been China, India, and the Philippines.
Yes,
all Asian countries. Mm-hmm. It's not in that order every year.
Yeah.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, Philippines was the largest source country last year. But between the three of them, they bounce around between one, two, and three.
Mm-hmm.
So that's changing who we are. Okay, and that is just understanding that, and they become a resource for us in the context of how we build our relationship in that part of the world.
So how, even though we're seeing the face of Canada change, how is that going to help us strengthen those economic ties across the Pacific?
There are many elements to our brand.
Yeah.
And the fact that we do have the diaspora, I would say 60 to 70% of the time it works in our favor. It doesn't always work in our favor, but it's an important element.
So you pointed out the fact that back in the 1980s when the Asia Pacific Foundation was first founded, when we thought of Asia, we thought of Japan. Well, Japan almost has had to step aside because predominant in our thinking is China. Do we run the risk of missing other opportunities if we only focus in on one country or the other because they happen to dominate the news
and be
powerhouses economically?
And I think, having spent 32 years in the Canadian Foreign Service, I don't think we've ever really had a concerted strategy for Asia, which is defined within the Department of Foreign Affairs, which becomes a government-wide strategy. So I think that's the reason why we tend to focus on what's, I won't call it the media darling, but in the context of an economy that is really dominant, and we don't really take a look at where the other opportunities will be. So when the foundation was established in 84, China was just coming out of the Cultural Revolution. Deng Xiaoping was just coming into power. He was beginning to make those changes. And we just, I can guarantee you, we had people in Beijing reporting back on what was happening. We didn't even have an office in Shanghai until 1986, okay? So, but people were talking about these changes that were happening in China. But because we were so focused on what Japan was doing, mm-hmm. we weren't paying attention to what was going on there. Nobody paid any attention to India, for that matter. So it this world has changed so rapidly around us. And it goes back to one of the things that we're spending a lot of time and money on right now, our own, the foundation money is on building Asia competence in the country.
for us to understand Asia.
Because
when you look at Asia and you think of China, oh, okay, I understand Asia. But it's not the same. It's not a homogeneous environment.
That's right.
Because everything from Australia up through India, Mongolia, and Japan, each one of those is a different culture.
Different
business culture as well.
So you go to India, for example. I mean, mainland China is way more homogeneous than India. Okay, I don't know how many languages you have in India. You have a lot of languages in China, but there's a common language of Mandarin. Okay, the common language in India is English, but it's not spoken by the majority of the population. Okay, but English is, you know, it's a bind within, you know, sort of the government structures and such like, but it's not spoken by everybody. And there's so many different cultures within India. So if I was working with, you know, a Canadian, whether it was a university or a business or an NGO or whatever coming to India, I'd say you'd have to take a look at this on a regional basis and even at a state level basis, just to be able to understand that what you do in Kerala, okay, in the south of India, versus what you do in Gujarat will be quite a bit different. And that's one country.
Right.
So at least I understand that because I lived and worked there for 4 years. But an average Canadian coming in who's had no exposure to India,
right?
You know, wow, what do
I do? What can the Asia Pacific Foundation do for people and organizations that say, okay, I want to improve my Asia competency and I need to be able to understand what I'm about to venture into if I want to start to open up ties into that incredible home to 60%+ of the world's population?
Well, I mean, it's in many ways it's a team effort because you have resources at the provincial level, you have resources at the federal level between the Trade Commissioner Service, and you've got EDC and BDC, and there are lots of resources out there. What we're trying to do from the foundation really is build it into the culture, our culture here, understanding Asia. So that's why we were working with the BC government in building Asia curriculum for grade 10 through grade 12 in high schools, which will be launched in the fall. So there'll be modules which will be inserted into the social study program, social studies and history program, so that people understand more about Asia. Because when you think back, and I think back to when I was in high school, all our learning was about Western Europe, ancient Rome, ancient Greece, you know, Egypt, I mean, and the United States, UK. So we had nothing on Asia.
So aside from the curriculum program, what else are you doing to help, you know, as many people as possible start to get a handle on what this incredible potential is?
So curriculum, that starts really at a younger age, but we're also focusing on post-secondary students. So we have a co-op program that we have in place now that we're matching. Right now we're investing quite a bit, but we want to bring in the private sector as well to put post-secondary students into Asia for 4 to 6 month work terms, not exchange programs, but co-op work terms. Again, because when you go on an exchange program, it doesn't always be the case, but most often you go into a university environment, which tends to be a bit of a bubble. When you go and work, you end up really understanding much better the culture because you have to deal with it differently. So it's a bursary program that we add to an existing co-op that a university would have. So UBC, we've been working with UVic, SFU, BCIT. So these academic institutions have work programs.
And that's a fantastic opportunity.
So, and why are we doing that? One is to introduce, again, people at the post-secondary level to this opportunity in Asia and to get them to see firsthand. When you go to a market like China, living in Shanghai, you have really no clue what it's like until you walk down Huahai Lu on a Saturday night and you see hundreds of thousands of people. And you think about walking in downtown Vancouver on a Saturday night, you know, it's just not the same
couple
experience.
Thousand.
And then you begin to understand the point you made about scale, okay?
Right.
You understand scale, and you understand that to be successful in a market like that, you have to price your products right. Maybe not so much so in China, but certainly in India. The Chinese have more disposable income, so they're willing to pay for that Gucci bag and more expensive products. But until you experience that, until you understand how you negotiate in an environment, what's involved in the culture, you know, what are people sensitive to, it's that experience which really changes how you approach things. So by having more of those students out there with that experience, but coming back and ideally being available for Canadian companies to employ, that's what we're trying to do.
So this is a shift in what you've been doing, because before I thought of you as being a think tank and providing government and academic institutions with that kind of insight, but now you're actually creating programs to make a difference.
Well, we're still, I wouldn't call us a think tank, I'd like to call us an action tank.
Okay.
Our focus is more on value-added research.
Yeah.
But we still do that. And we work for both the federal and provincial governments in that particular area. But what we're trying to do is really change the dial on people's understanding of Asia.
Yeah.
And the purpose of the foundation was its initial purpose.
Mm.
And it's, I'm not saying it didn't achieve it since the mid-80s when it was been in place, but I mean, ultimately for us to make that pivot, to impact in that market, we need more people engaged in understanding the importance of it. So that's what we're really focusing our efforts on right now.
Because now's the time.
Now's the time.
To seize that opportunity.
You know, quite frankly, now's the time to seize that opportunity was in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not, I hate to say we're a little late to the game in many ways. And to catch up is gonna require an investment mm-hmm. of effort. And that's gonna have to be in some ways, all three levels of government. Certainly the federal government needs to take leadership,
mm-hmm.
and then the other governments need to resource it.
Yeah.
And I look at BC, and it's not because we're based here, but you take a look at the numbers will tell you. So what percentage of exports from British Columbia now go to Asia versus what percentage of the exports from Ontario go to Asia?
Mm-hmm.
It's because partly it's here, but also partly they've created the strategies and they've resourced those strategies. And you see it when it comes to, at the municipal level as well. We're here, but we see what the work that the Vancouver Economic Commission does, Advantage BC, the organizations that are here that really add to the process, HQ Vancouver, they're all focused on being able to generate that type of interaction and engagement with Asia. It tends to be focused on China, which is a little bit worrisome to me. I know the BC government is setting up offices in other markets in Asia, which is important. But keeping that in mind, can't take your eye off the ball, but there are other things, mm-hmm. other countries out there that can really be great partners.
Well, any momentum that we've started to gather, we have to keep moving
That's
forward.
Right.
Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.